Johnson just shoveled it on goal and plucked it held by Leonard. What a way for the Chicago Blackhawks to start the second period. They're pushing the pace of this thing, and they've come for a really good shot block right here by Jonathan Munster, so we might have a 2-1 score. And then another opportunity for the Brinkett.
In this book, Grant's Last Battle, the story behind the personal memoirs of Ulysses S. Grant. There's a new edition of this book that just came out in the spring. The foreword is written by Jared Harris, the actor who played Grant in Steven Spielberg's Lincoln movie. And it was just a real delight and honor to be able to work with Jared on that new foreword. So if you're looking for more information about the content I'm going to be talking about tonight, Grant's Last Battle, available as part of the Emerging Civil War series from Savvis Beatty. When Ulysses S. Grant was a small kid, he had this habit when he would go someplace, if he missed the turn, he would not turn around and go back. Instead, he would keep going and then find a different route and circle in from the other side. It's something he wrote about in his memoirs, a habit he had. There would be no turning back. And this, of course, becomes one of his most famous phrases during the Civil War, because in May of 1864, when he is accompanying the Army of the Potomac, and they cross the Rapidan River from the area around Culpeper and Brandy Station, he tells a reporter, there'll be no turning back. He's going to continue onward, engage Robert E. Lee's Army of Northern Virginia, and continue onward toward Richmond if necessary, but toward the ultimate destruction of the Army of Northern Virginia. In fact, he says he'll fight it out along this line if it takes all summer. There'll be no turning back. And he holds true to that word, and he just keeps pounding on that Army of Northern Virginia. And what starts there in the wilderness in May of 1864 inexorably leads to Appomattox Courthouse in April of 1865. There was no turning back. That road's eventually going to take him to 2 terms in the White House. He'll eventually have the opportunity to come back for a 3rd term, but his political operatives botched that for him. And he says, that's probably just as well. I should not go back to that. I've moved on. It's just as well, because there should be no turning back. After his presidency, he takes a round-the-world trip that lasts 2 years. Halfway through the trip, he starts to run out of money. He's not known for being a financial whiz, and he has not lived as frugally as possible. But instead of turning around, he wires to his son Fred back in the United States, who makes some financial arrangements, gets some more money to Grant, and Grant and his wife Julia adjust their living conditions so that they're living in more moderate style, and onward they continue. Again, no turning back. This is really going to be in his mind when he's offered the opportunity, after he returns to the United States, to write his memoirs. And instead, he says, I don't need to relive that. He works with one of his staff members, Adam Badow, to write the 3-volume military history of Ulysses S. Grant that Badow writes. It gets Grant's blessing. He doesn't need to revisit that. He says it's all in Badow. There's no turning back. But he will reconsider this motto starting in 1884. And it all happens because of a peach. And the reason that he's going to have to reconsider this lifelong habit because of this peach is because he's going to find himself financially destitute, on the brink of absolute, utter financial ruin. He's also going to find himself in a race against the clock because of terminal cancer. And he's got to then suddenly find a way to provide for his family. And in order to do that, he will turn back the pages of his life and begin to write his story in a race against the clock to provide for his family. To kind of set the scene for us, we have to kind of start in May of 1864. Grant, upon his return to New York, is set up in a financial firm called Grant & Ward. There are 4 partners. His youngest son, Buck, is one of the partners. He kind of does the day-to-day operations of the firm. It's a financial investment firm. He's got another partner, James Fish, who is the president of Marine Bank, one of the largest banks in New York City at the time, and Ferdinand Ward, a man known as the Napoleon of Wall Street, 30 years old, and he's a financial wizard. And really, Ward is the brains behind the operation. Grant lends the prestige of his name to the firm, and pretty much that's about it. He goes to his office every day and works on personal projects. He's trying to help, for instance, the ambassador of Mexico get a rail line through Mexico to Mexico City to help open up development in the country. Ward will occasionally come in with some paperwork that Grant will sign, and off it goes. But otherwise, Grant comes to the office where Ward has laid out 20 cigars on his desk, and Grant will puff through his 20 cigars over the course of the day, doing his projects, and that's pretty much his involvement in the firm. But on Sunday, May 4th, 1884, Ward shows up at Grant's house. He's got a brownstone at 66 number 3, 66th Street in New York City. And Ward knocks on the door. Grant's in his parlor, and Ward is ushered in, and he sits down on the couch and says to Grant, "Marine Bank is in trouble." And Grant says, "Okay. Why is that of concern to us?" With Grant and Ward. "Well," Ward says, "all of our money is invested in Marine Bank. And if the bank should fail to open its doors, that'll be a huge embarrassment to us." Grant says, "Okay, well, how much of a problem is this?" "Well," Ward says, "they're short about $400,000. Now, I've managed to come up with about $250,000, but is there any way that you might be able to come up with that balance, that $150,000? Just temporarily, just enough so that the bank can open its doors. It'll all be taken care of." Grant says, "All right, I'll see what I can do." So he gets his beaver skin top hat and he heads out into his carriage and off through the city to pay some calls on some friends. And one of the first places he stops is at the home of William Henry Vanderbilt, who, just as an aside, has one of the great crazy beards in an era that is full of crazy beards. Think of Ambrose Burnside gone to seed, which is these big, huge, sharp sideburns off the side. I love him. He's the wealthiest man in the world. He's made his fortune on railroads, industrialization. Grant goes in, he explains the situation to Vanderbilt. Vanderbilt flat out says, "I don't care about Marine Bank. Frankly, I don't care about Grant and Ward. But you, my friend, I care about." And Vanderbilt gets out his checkbook and writes a personal check to Grant. And he says, "This is payable to you as a personal loan to you and you only." And Grant accepts it as such, says, "Thank you very much. This will all be squared away tomorrow. I've been told everything will be fine. It's just a matter of liquidity. Thank you so much for your assistance. And I'll get this right back to you." And Grant goes back and he gives the check to Ward. Ward's, "Oh, thank you very much." And off he goes to take care of things. Monday morning comes. Everything looks fine. Marine Bank opens as promised. And everything looks absolutely fine. But Grant's son, Fred, is a little suspicious. Ward's been acting a little hinky around the office and he's not sure why. And so Buck and his father-in-law, Senator Jerome Chafee, both have a lot of money invested in this firm, and Chafee's lawyer goes with Fred to pay a visit to Ferdinand Ward on Monday evening. And Ward's wife says, "Oh, well, I'm sorry, Ferdy's not here right now." And Fred says, "Okay, well, we'll wait in the parlor for his return." And they wait for 4 hours, midnight, when Ferdinand Ward finally shows up at the door, doorway to the parlor. He's like, "Oh, sorry to keep you waiting. I didn't realize you were here. And sorry I was out." And they explain the situation, and Ward says, "Everything's fine. Here, you know, everything's absolutely fine." And so Chafee's lawyer says, "Well, if everything's fine, then you wouldn't mind writing a check to my client to reimburse him for his investment in the firm." And Ward says, no, not at all. And he writes out a check, gives it to the attorney, and he and Fred leave, and everything seems fine. But Fred says, "Did you notice when Ward showed up in the parlor, he was in his bedroom slippers? He had been in the house the whole time." and was trying to wait us out. The next morning, Tuesday, Grant gives an interview to his hometown paper from back in St. Louis. He says things are going great. You know, there's a great sense of reconciliation that is sweeping the country. The country's financial situation is doing wonderfully. And Grant, and he himself, is really enjoying his post-presidency retirement. Things could not be better. Gets in the carriage, goes to his office. It's 11 o'clock. And when he gets out of the carriage, he sees the front of his office has a huge cluster of angry investors screaming out front. And his son, Fred, is on the front doorstep, besieged by all these angry investors. And Fred sees his dad and he says, "Marine Bank has closed. Ward can't be found. The bottom is out of the tub and Ward has the key to the safe." They're ruined. All of their investments are gone with the bank. Grant, as often was his case, had a very somber expression in the face of crisis, holds his composure, pushes his way through the crowd into the office, goes to his second floor office, and waits for news. And over the course of the day, his assistant brings him more reports. And it turns out that the firm is $16.5 million in the red. Ward has swindled them all. In fact, by the end of the day, Grant says, "I don't know how I will ever be able to trust another man again." Investigation will determine that Ward was running what today we would call a Ponzi scheme. He was taking an investment from Kim and taking an investment from John, putting it in the bank. You go to Mark and get money from Mark and take some of that money and give it back to Kim. And Kim would be like, "Oh, look, I'm getting returns already. Well, here's some more money." And Kim would give Ferdinand Ward some more money and he'd give some of that to John. And John would be like, "Oh, this is fantastic." Meanwhile, he'll go to Stephanie, he'll go to Mike Block and he'll be like, "Oh, look, these people are getting returns. You want to give me some money?" And so he was taking from Peter to pay Paul. And it's no wonder people were literally throwing money at Ward because they were getting returns of up to 40% on their investments. And all of the stock rating firms gave the investment firm an A-plus rating. It had the highest security rating in the city. No wonder he was called the Napoleon of Wall Street. In fact, Grant's wife, Julia, said that everybody in the whole family had money invested in the firm because to not invest the money felt like they were losing money. Ward stopped by their house one day, saw a jar of silver dollars on the fireplace mantel and said, "You ought to invest that in the firm." She gave over the silver dollars. Everyone in the family had invested in the firm only to find out that Ward had swindled them. By the end of the day, Grant discovers he has about $85 in his pocket. When he gets home that night to break the news to Julia, she has another $120 in a cookie jar. And that's everything the Grant family has to their name. As it turns out, again, through these investigations, it quickly becomes apparent that Grant had nothing to do with it. At first, his political enemies tried to make political hay out of it. And like, "Oh, was Grant dishonest? Was he in on the scheme?" And that really wounds Grant, who, of course, is as the man who won the Civil War, is the man who was 2 terms as president, his personal honor was something very important to him. So to be accused of such malfeasance was deeply wounding to him. But it quickly becomes apparent that he was not involved. So then his critics shift gears a little bit. It's like, "Oh, so he wasn't to blame. So does that just mean he was negligent? Was he criminally negligent?" And again, this continues to bother Grant. He pledges that he's going to repay every single dollar he can by the time, you know, as long as it takes. He's going to pledge himself to repay what he can. $16.5 million is a lot of dollars in 1884. What saves Grant is the rallying of public support that comes to his aid. As it becomes apparent that he was not part of the criminality of it, people start to send him some money. The first comes from a guy named Alfred Wood from Lansing, New York. And Wood was an industrialist during the war. And he sends Grant a loan for $500. And he says, please accept this as a loan, payable at your convenience, due for my part of services rendered on April 9th, 1865. In other words, because of Lee's surrender and you winning the war, please accept this. Grant accepts it because it is couched as a loan. He has other people that offer to give him money and he declines. He's too proud to accept charity, but he will take a loan that is something that he can repay. Wood will send him another $1,000. Grant sends him a note, says, you have no idea how grateful I am to the loan that you have given me that kept me and my family afloat at this moment of crisis. I promise that I will pay you back. And that's when Wood sends him that extra $1,000. Grant will pay that $1,500 back. Wood does not want to take money from the former president, and so he'll actually donate that money to charity in Grant's name. Someone else who gives Grant money during that crucial time is the ambassador to Mexico, the man that was helping him with the railroad project. Mexican ambassador comes and pays his respects and offers his apologies and condolences, and on the way out, he slips $500 onto the table in Grant's front hallway as he leaves. The other thing that becomes really important for Grant at this time are his former soldiers who begin to rally around him. He was invited to be the marshal of the Memorial Day parade in Brooklyn, New York that year. And he doesn't want to go. He's embarrassed, but he's like, oh, come on, you know, come on, come on. Phil Sheridan is the general in chief of the army at the time. He's the other co-marshal. And he tells Grant, you need to come, you need to come. And when Grant is ferried across the river to Brooklyn and tens of thousands of people greet him on his arrival, and tens of thousands of more people line the streets to see him, cheering wildly at his arrival, it does a lot to buoy his spirits. Maybe, just maybe, people don't hate him after all, even though he's deeply embarrassed by what has happened. The next month, the Grand Army of the Republic gets together in Philadelphia for its annual conference, and they elect Grant their honorary president. And again, to see the men under his former command rally around him, and they don't just give the customary three cheers, but they give three sets of three cheers, so loud that one newspaper correspondent says you could hear it down the block, echoing from the building that shook with the cheers of these men and their loud acclaim for their former commander. Grant is very humbled by this. Also that month, Grant has an invitation to speak to alumni of the United States Christian Commission, a charitable organization that operated throughout the war. George Stewart, the millionaire philanthropist from New York City, a friend of Grant's, invites him to speak. It's just down the road from Grant's summer cottage in Long Branch, New Jersey. Grant shows up, and when he gets there and he stands in front of the podium about to address the audience, and they all stand and give him a wild ovation, and Grant breaks down in the middle of his comments. He can't finish. He's so moved, literally to tears. And he realizes that if these people, these true angels of the battlefield, he calls them, if they could stand in his support, then maybe, just maybe, he should not be ashamed. Maybe he can look at himself in the mirror. And these are the things that kind of buoy him through this time. His wife, Julia, sells off virtually every property that they own, including her homestead, Whitehaven in St. Louis. She said it moves her to tears when she has to sign that paperwork. But she says, imagine us who thought that we were independently wealthy to find suddenly that we were destitute. It struck, she said, like a thunderbolt. And so she's moved to do what she can to try to help the family's financial situation. The one place they can't sell is their property in Long Branch on the shore. They can't find a good market price for it. So the Grants move there along with other members of their family who are also destitute from the collapse of the firm. Julia said if there's any silver lining to the situation, it's that they got to be surrounded by their grandchildren. They can't even sell their townhouse their brownstone. That'd be 66th Street. Turns out that they don't even own it. The attorney who handled the sale for them was Ferdinand Ward. And he had taken enough money to put down a down payment so everybody could move in, but then he invested the rest in his pyramid scheme. So the Grants, it turns out, don't even own their own home and can't use that as collateral. And so they hunker down in Long Branch trying to weather this financial storm. It's at about this time that a young editor at Century Magazine comes up with the idea to have Grant start to write about his personal experiences in the war. Now, the editors had come up with this idea that they wanted to get the most prominent survivors of the war to write accounts about their experiences during the war and run it as a series in their magazine. It is what today we now know as Battles and Leaders. But at the time, they were convinced that with Lincoln dead and with Lee dead, Grant was like the most prominent survivor, and they had to have something from Grant in order to make this a success, in order to get people to buy, and in order to get other officers and prominent figures to contribute. They had to have Grant. So they approached him first in January of 84, and he said no. He had no desire to relive any of that. There was no turning back, remember? He said it was all in Badow already. And so that basically knocks the idea out from under the editors, who abandon it. But when they hear about Grant's financial situation, the editor in charge of the project, Robert Underwood Johnson, decides to reapproach Grant and say, like, here's an opportunity for you to earn some money at a time when you need some through your own work. Would you be interested in doing some of this writing? And Grant immediately says, why don't you come down to Long Branch and let's talk about it. So Johnson makes the trip from New York down to New Jersey. And when he gets to Long Branch, he said that there was a pall of gloom around the house. And then when he first met Grant, his impression was of a wounded lion. But Grant was quite frank about his situation, explained everything to Johnson, and eagerly accepted the opportunity to try to earn some money. Again, he wouldn't accept charity, but here's an opportunity through his own efforts to try to get some financial security. So they decide that Grant's going to write four different articles for $500 a piece. He's going to write about Vicksburg. He's going to write about the wilderness. He's going to write about Appomattox, and he's going to write about Shiloh. Shiloh will be his first piece. And Johnson goes back to New York delighted that he's going to have this man write about these four key components. Grant quickly sends a note and says, you know, instead of writing about Appomattox, I'd actually rather write about Chattanooga. The other editors are like, what? I mean, like, our readers want to know about Appomattox the most. And Johnson says, listen, let's just let him write what he wants to write. I've always thought it was really interesting that Grant thought Chattanooga was more important to write about than Appomattox. That really tells us a lot about his thinking about the importance of Chattanooga and what that leads to in the war. So important, in fact, that when he finally writes his memoirs, he's going to split it into two volumes. He's going to end the first one after Vicksburg and start the next one at Chattanooga to give it that extra prominence. Pretty cool, a little bit of insight. So Grant immediately sets to writing, and he starts going, and he sends in a report to Johnson, and Johnson gets it, opens it up all excited, and reads it, and it is terrible. It is so bad that Johnson actually calls it the second disaster of Shiloh. It's very formal, very official, lots of blah, 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 blah to it. It's dry and boring. Johnson doesn't know what he's going to do. So he folds up the letter and he puts it in his pocket and he goes back down to Long Branch to talk to Grant. And without getting out the letter, he just pulls up a chair and he sits down with Grant on the deck outside and he says, I got your article. Thank you for sending it. Before we talk about the article, though, just tell me a little bit more about the battle. And Grant just started to unload, telling him everything. Grant, who by reputation was rather reserved, became, in Johnson's words, rather loquacious. And they just start talking, and Grant's got all these great stories and all these great tales, and Johnson says, that's it. That's the way I want you to write your story, as though you're talking across the breakfast table with a friend. And without even referring to the first story, Grant immediately said, ah, I understand. I know what you want. Okay. And he later wrote that it was like a light bulb going off over his head, or like a candle illuminating what was up for him. He immediately recognized what was required for public readership. So Grant sets to work on a second draft, and it's just a couple of weeks, and he sends it back to Johnson, and Johnson thinks it's fantastic. It needs a few minor edits, but overall it's good, clean copy. It's engaging. It's clear. It's exactly what Johnson was hoping for. And he sends encouraging word back to Grant, says, this is great. Keep going. And so Grant continues to write. As he sets on the second article, he's going to write about the wilderness next. And he writes off to Adam Baddow, his former staff member. And he says, listen, the Century Magazine has talked me into this project. Because of my financial situation, I've got to do this. But I'm not a writer. You know, you're the professional writer. You've written books. And would you mind looking this stuff over? I prefer to have your approval of it before I send the next article on. And Baddow says, sure, that'd be great. I'd be glad to do that for you. And so this is how the story would have unfolded, with Grant continuing to write and having a pretty good time of it, and eventually writing enough pieces that he would probably decide to write his memoirs, and we would have this great story from the leading figure of the war. Except for that peach. This is where the peach comes in on June 3rd. 1884. Grant was outside on the deck at Long Branch, and he comes inside, and there on the table, Julia later wrote, was a bowl of fresh peaches, of which the general was particularly fond, she said. And he decided to take a bite of one of the dainty morsels, she says. And he takes a bite of the peach, and suddenly, something stings him, and he puts the peach down, and he starts pacing, and this burning in his throat is terrible, and he thinks that there's some insect in the peach. He tries to wash it out with water, and that hurts too. And he's incredibly uncomfortable. And Julia's like, well, what's up? She wants him to go see a doctor. And he's like, no. And in true soldierly fashion, he essentially says, I'll rub some dirt on it and walk it off. He just wraps a scarf around his neck to give it a little counter pressure. And he goes back out onto the porch and picks up his pen and paper and continues writing for the rest of the day. But his throat still bothers him by dinner time, so much so that he can't have dinner. So his wife's like, you need to go see the doctor. And he's like, I'll go see the doctor, but he won't. So after a couple of days, she goes and gets the doctor for them. Their next door neighbor is a newspaper publisher from Philadelphia named George Childs. And Childs' doctor happens to be visiting for the week. And so Julia brings Childs and Childs' doctor over and says, take a look at my husband's throat. His throat is bothering him. Something stung him from that peach. So the doctor takes a look at Grant's throat. He's not sure he likes what he sees. He says, you really need to go and get that taken care of and go see your doctor when you get back to the city. But he gives him a prescription for a mild sedative to a mild pain reliever for his throat. So Grant promises that he'll go see his doctor when they get back to the city. His doctor is Fordyce Barker, who happens to be in Europe for the summer. And so it won't be until October before Grant finally goes to get this checked out. When he does, Barker takes a look, does an examination, doesn't like what he sees, and says, I want to refer you to a friend of mine who is a specialist on throat ailments. His name is John Hancock Douglas. His office is across town. So Grant goes over that afternoon and sees Dr. Douglas, and Douglas takes a look at Grant's throat. He doesn't like what he sees either. But before he can say anything, Grant says, is it cancer? And Douglas later writes that I knew in that moment that if I were to lie to him, I would never regain his trust again. And so Douglas says, it is epithelial in nature, sometimes known to be curable. Grant lets that sink in. And he nods his head and he says, what do I need to do? And Douglas prescribes a twice-a-day treatment where Grant should come into the office and Douglas will scrape away the dead tissue in the back of his throat and then administer a cocaine mixture, a topical cocaine mixture that will dull the pain. And Grant submits to this for 2 weeks. We'll get on the trolley car because he doesn't want to waste the money on a private cab, and he'll take the public trolley car to Douglas's office. In the meantime, Douglas, not liking what he sees, has taken a sample, and he goes to a friend of his, a colleague named George Schrady, who specializes in throat cancer. And without telling Schrady any of the details, he just gives him the samples, and Schrady looks at him, and he says, oh, this comes from the back of the throat. He looks at it some more, and very aggressive. Douglas says, well, the patient is General Grant. And Schrady says, then General Grant is doomed. It's pretty serious. But Grant continues on a daily basis, twice a day, to go and get this treatment. Meanwhile, his wife is wondering, like, where are you going every day, twice a day? Where are you off to? And so she and Fred actually follow him one day, and they get to Douglas's office, and that's how she finds out that her husband has throat cancer, because she confronts the doctor. And, you know, Grant didn't want to say anything because he didn't want to worry her. And she, you know, almost loses her mind. She writes in her memoirs about, you know, what a blow this was to imagine this great, good man, that this could happen to him and that he could be taken from us, and what a calamity this would be. But Grant just takes things in stride. By November, he's visiting the Hudson Valley in New York and overlooking a horse ranch with the nephew of George Gordon Meade, as it happens. And he says, gentlemen, this is my final cigar. The doctors have told me that I need to stop smoking. And so he smokes his final cigar because it's been aggravating his throat. He's been smoking 20 cigars a day, essentially since Fort Donelson, where a sketch artist had portrayed him riding into the battle holding a cigar. And admirers, after that victory, had sent him cigars after cigars after cigars. The man never wanted for a cigar again the rest of his life. And he smoked them because they were there. There's a famous account in the wilderness on the first day as he's sitting under a tree and he's whittling and smoking cigars and goes through 20 cigars in a day. If you go to the visitor center in Chancellorsville, there's actually a display with 20 cigars lined up. And this becomes his lifelong habit. Ferdinand Ward leaves him 20 cigars on his desk every morning. Now it has caught up to him. And so this is going to change the calculus for Grant as he is writing. And he starts to think that maybe these articles aren't enough. Maybe he should write a book, because that would then secure finances for his family after his death. And as he starts to think about this, he talks to Robert Underwood Johnson, the editor at Century Magazine. Century thinks about selling the book by subscription. And as buzz starts to generate about this book, another one of Grant's friends hears about it. And I love this part because this is like one of the most colorful people in all of American history comes strolling into this story with hands in his pockets. And it's ironic that this colorful character is known today for his white suits and his big shock of white hair and his big bushy white mustache, Mark Twain. And Twain and Grant had been friends for years. And Twain, of course, ran his own publishing company. And he wanted Grant to write his memoirs and publish them, and Grant had turned him down once upon a time. When he hears wind of this business opportunity, he goes to see Grant. And when he gets to Grant's house, he sees that Grant's actually sitting at his desk going over a contract from Century Magazine. His son Fred is there with him. And Grant sees Twain walk in, and Grant says, oh, sit down over there until I finish up with this this contract. And one of Grant's granddaughters described Twain as a man who entered a room and walked about it as though he had no particular destination in mind when he came in the room. And he saunters into the room and he sort of plops himself down on the chair. And Twain later writes that he sees this business opportunity evaporate in front of his eyes. But quickly he says, well, what are you working on there? Grant says, well, this is a contract to write my memoirs for Century Magazine. And Twain says, well, why don't you have Fred read that out loud to me? You know, I know some stuff about publishing. Maybe I can give you some advice. Just kind of check that contract for you. Fred says, well, that'd be a good idea. So Grant says, okay. Fred reads the contract out loud. And when they get to the part about royalties, Twain says, stop right there. Now, cross that out. Century Magazine wants to offer 10% royalties on the book, which even today is pretty standard. Twain says, cross that out and say 80%. In fact, cross that out and say 80% of the gross. Grant's like, what publisher would agree to those terms? And Twain says, well, Century should. You know, like everybody's going to buy this. It's going to make a lot of money. It's your story. You should get the financial repercussions from it. Grant says, tell me one publisher that would accept those terms. Grant says, well, I can tell you one. And so they start talking and you know, Twain uses his opportunity to start making the pitch for his publishing company. And finally, as they're going back and forth, Grant says, well, Century came to me first. I feel obligated to deal with them. And Twain says, well, if it's a matter of who came to you first, and he recalls a time just a few years ago when he and his friend William Dean Howells stopped by Grant's office on Wall Street. Grant and Warren. And of course, Twain and Grant were both famous cigar smokers. So, you know, they spent afternoons together and smoking cigars and talking about the state of the world. And with William Dean Howells there, Howells wanted a favor for his dad who'd been a postmaster and had been displaced. And Grant says, well, I'll write to the president and take care of that for him. Well, in the course of that conversation, Twain said, you should write your memoirs, you know, and I can get them published for you. And at that point, Grant's like, God, you know, no turning back. I don't need to do that. That's all in bed. And, you know, Twain worked at it, but Grant said no. So in Grant's parlor that October afternoon, Grant reminds him of this conversation. If it's a matter of who came to you first, and Grant sits down in his pen, says, go on. And they start talking and Fred says, well, you should at least think about it. And, you know, maybe Sam can come back tomorrow and talk about it some more. And so Twain says, yes, that'd be great. I'll come back tomorrow. Just think about it overnight. And Twain comes back the next day and the three of them talk about it some more. And so Grant starts to like, okay, open up to this idea. Twain's about to leave on a national lecture tour. And he says, I'll be back in February. You just send me word whenever you want, when you've made up your mind. But, you know, I'm going to do you right. And to his credit, Twain will go to great lengths to protect Grant's interests with these memoirs and will give him generous terms. They'll actually assign the copyright to Julia so that if any of Grant's creditors try to come in and swoop in on those profits, they won't be able to because Julia will have them. And to his great credit, Twain really protects Grant. The two of them had a relationship that dated back to Grant's presidency when Twain worked as the secretary from one of the new senators from Nevada. And the senator's like, you want to meet the president? Come on, I'll introduce you. And they go in and Grant, sitting behind his desk, is wearing an expression on his face, Twain says, of a man who has not smiled in 7 years and was not scheduled to smile for another 7. And Twain and Grant exchange introductions, and it's pretty awkward. Twain finally says, I don't know about you, Mr. President, but I'm feeling pretty awkward right now. And Twain later says that the president cracked just the hint of a smile 7 years ahead of schedule. After Grant's presidency and he takes his round the world trip, he lands in San Francisco and travels from west to east, and partway across the country in Chicago, they're having a big reunion of the Army of the Tennessee where Grant is supposed to be the guest of honor. And they ask Twain to deliver essentially the keynote address of the banquet. So on Friday, the Grant Army is making its review down one of the main boulevards in front of the hotel, and Twain's on the porch of his hotel watching the army march by. And then all of a sudden the army just raises up in this wild, crazy cheer. And Twain looks down the balcony and he sees Grant there, and the army is cheering for him. And Grant turns and he sees Twain and he says, I don't know about you, Mr. Clemens, but I'm not feeling awkward at all today. And the two of them really hit it off at that conversation. So they hang out for the weekend. The last night of the review, big banquet, alcohol soaked, cigar smoke, Twain has to bat cleanup after 23 speeches, a position he later says that no speaker ever requested. And over the course of the evening, people are like saying, oh, I proposed to the men, I proposed to the officers, I proposed to the ladies, I proposed a toast to this, I proposed a toast to that. So when Twain gets up, he finally says that, we have remembered all of these different audiences, all these different people tonight, but the one group that we have forgotten about are the babies. Everyone's like, what is he talking about? Twain says, I would like to propose a toast to the babies, because somewhere out there tonight in America is the next Ulysses S. Grant, who even today is a baby. That person is a baby today, just as Grant once was a baby, who once upon a time focused his entire formidable powers of concentration on getting his big toe into his mouth. And the whole audience just held its breath like, what is he? And Grant just burst out laughing, thought it was hilarious. And that sort of let the breath out of the whole rest of the room, which then also starts laughing. And Twain continues on. He says in his journal, oh, I had him in the palm of my hands, had him busting up. It was fantastic. And this kind of relationship the two of them had when Grant had his business in Grant and Ward in New York, Twain would come down and hang out, smoke cigars. And so this is what will eventually persuade Grant to go with Twain as his publisher and forego Century Magazine. Johnson, to his great credit, very disappointed that his company does not get the book project, but he's very gracious in defeat. And he says in his own memoirs that working with Grant was one of the great honors and privileges of his entire long storied career. So Grant decides he's going to write out this memoir, take these newspaper or these magazine articles and parlay them into something larger. But at about this time, he runs into writer's block, but it's really the stages of grief that are starting to settle in as he's really starting to understand that he's running up against the clock here. And he can't write. He becomes deeply depressed. Adam Baddow moves in with the Grant family as they all move back to their townhouse. William Vanderbilt helps them get things straightened out and the title to their house so they can move back into it. Baddow moves in to help Grant with his writing project, and Grant can't write anything. In fact, some of his grandkids will sometimes swarm in the afternoons, and Julia will be like, no, no, kids, come out of there, let Grandpa work. And Grandpa will be like, no, no, let them stay in here. This is the one thing that's keeping me going right now, is to be surrounded by these wonderful children. In December, just before Christmas, Grant gets a visit for a few days from his old friend, Comp Sherman. The two of them have grown distant since the war. Sherman didn't like the way that Grant was hobnobbing with the rich and famous in New York. That wasn't the Grant that he knew. But he comes and pays a visit, and Julia's like, I just don't know what to do. Ulysses just, he's so despondent. He doesn't say anything. He doesn't talk. And Sherman says, well, Mrs. Grant, you have to remember that your husband's never really been much of a talker to begin with. And that was like a touchstone moment for Julia, she writes in her memoirs, to be reminded that her husband is in there underneath this pall of gloom. Sherman's visit seems to buoy Grant's spirits, and it really helps. But Sherman does write in his own personal letters to people, he says, yeah, Grant's in much worse shape than any of us were led to believe. And he doesn't know that Grant is actually suffering from terminal cancer. He just knows that he's somehow sick. And now he starts to worry. But Grant's spirits start to buoy a little bit. Then into the next person who comes into the cast of characters, another very colorful figure, is P.T. Barnum, the great showman. Barnum comes to Grant with what he thinks is a way for Grant to earn money. When Grant went on that round-the-world trip, everybody gave him gifts. And it's like his townhouse is a museum, an international museum of antiquities and charms and just all these wonderful gifts. And Barnum says, why don't we take those things on a cross-country exhibition. We'll charge people $1 a piece to get in and see it. You'll make a whole bunch of money. You'll be able to pay off your debts. You know, you'll be able to secure your family's fortune. And Grant likes the idea. But as they talk about it, because the title of the house, the mortgage, that stuff is still trying to get squared away, he doesn't feel as though he owns the stuff outright and therefore doesn't feel he has control to be able to send that stuff away. And so Barnum will leave disappointed. Grant will also be disappointed because that would have been a way out of his financial situation. As they continue negotiations with Vanderbilt, they have all of that stuff appraised. As it turns out, conveniently, it was worth exactly $150,000. So Grant gives it to Vanderbilt, squares the deal. Ironically, Vanderbilt at one point wanted to just forgive the loan, and Grant refused to allow Vanderbilt to excuse the loan. In fact, took Vanderbilt to court to force Vanderbilt to enforce the loan. Grant did not want to welch out on that. So they're able to use all these things from this trip to square the deal, square ownership of the house. Vanderbilt immediately turns around, donates it to the National Archives. All those things are still in the government's possessions today. Grant later says that he's immensely satisfied by the outcome because it's exactly what he had planned to do with those things in the first place. But because no good deed goes unpunished, the New York media beats Vanderbilt up for trying to squeeze money out of this, this poor, unfortunate, financially destitute president. Vanderbilt can't win for losing here. But it does square things up. The other thing that's going to help at this point is Grant's supporters in Congress try to get his pension reinstated. When he became president, he had to give up his military rank and as such give up his military pension. The presidency didn't come with a pension. And so his supporters in Congress want to try to get that reinstated. And in fact, the Speaker of the House is a Democrat and still wants to help Grant out. But because of all sorts of other political wrangling, it gets down to inauguration day, and it doesn't look like the bill for Grant's pension is going to get approved because of other bills that are getting held up. So they finally broker a deal. Some guy volunteers to not run for re-election so someone else can have his seat in order to then move this legislation forward. The Speaker of the House gets the motion passed. Meanwhile, everyone's gathering in the front of the Capitol for the swearing in of the new president. And the Speaker of the House runs and gets all the senators and pushes them into the Senate. The clerk of the Senate stands up on a chair and turns the clock back 20 minutes. So it now says 11:40 instead of noon, which is inauguration time. It's enough time for the Senate to pass the legislation, and they get it in before inauguration. So Grant's pension will get restored. It gets $20,000 a year, plus an allocation for horses. That will all go to Julia after his death. So finally, his financial security is put in place for Julia. At this point, though, nobody knows that he's actually dying. They just know that he's financially destitute. But for Grant, this becomes a huge lifesaver. So now the pressure's off for him to write. Except by this point, he loves what he's doing. He's discovered the pride of authorship. He's discovered that he has something to say. And it's nothing short of what the war meant. And this is the great age of reconciliation, is North and South, the veterans from both sides are coming together. And he really wants the opportunity through his writing to try to define what the war meant and what this reconciliation meant and have his stamp on it before he leaves. So he's going to keep writing, and he loves it. He's going to write 6 days a week, sometimes even on Sundays he writes. He'll get 10,000, 12,000 words a week done. Twain, when he sees Grant's progress, can't believe it. He says, it takes me twice that long to get half as much done, and it's agony the whole time. But as he reads Grant's words, he says that Grant is writing a masterpiece. The language is clear, concise, insightful. It rivals Caesar's commentaries. It is so good. And so Twain is letting him just go, and Grant is having a great time of it. Toward the end of March, lawyers show up to take Grant's deposition about his business partner, Ferdinand Ward, and his other business partner, James Fish. Adam Baddow sits in on the deposition, and Baddow later writes that Grant let those two men have it with both barrels and just unloads on the perfidy of Ward and Fish as co-collaborators. Both men will end up getting convicted. Ward will serve out 5 of 7 years. Fish will serve out, I think, 3 of 6. One will be in Auburn, New York. The other will be in Sing Sing. And it's such an exhausting ordeal for Grant that when the lawyers leave, he just has to go to bed. He's so worn out. The next day, he can't get up. He develops this cough from talking all day the day before. His throat is aggravated, and he starts coughing. He's feeling weak. The next day, he's in worse shape. Doctors come in, and they see this sudden, precipitous deterioration in Grant's condition. He can't breathe. And then word leaks out to the press, and headlines appear in the New York newspapers, Grant dying. And the city is in shock. And people gather on the sidewalk outside of the townhouse on East 66th Street. They hold vigil, staying all night with candles. A hush falls over the country as they wait for word of what happens to Grant. And the prognosis is grim. The doctors don't expect him to rally. Twain, in his journal, says that everyone waited for the peal of the bells that would announce the passing of the great man. But one evening then, he hacks up a piece of loose flesh from the back of his throat the size of a small lizard, he later says. And that allows him to suddenly breathe a little easier. And he falls asleep and actually has the first good night of rest in a week. And the next morning, he's feeling well enough that he actually gets out of bed and goes to the window to see the crowd that is assembled out there. And he waves. And there's this audible cheer, this sigh of relief that comes from the assembled people. The next day, Grant feels well enough that he actually takes a carriage ride to go out and get some fresh air. And it seems as though the crisis has passed. It's early April by this point. The anniversary of Appomattox is just around the bend. He starts getting cards and well wishes. His birthday comes just after that, later on in April. People write to him from all across the country, thanking him for his service, the 20th anniversary of Appomattox, wishing him a happy birthday, everyone wishing him well. He gets just deluged with so many cards and letters and bits of correspondence that he issues a public statement and thanks people for their concern and says that even were I a well man, I would not be able to respond to all of this outpouring of generosity. But please know how much I appreciate your thoughts and your prayers. Easter also comes at that time of year, a time of resurrection. And many people make this comparison to Grant's sudden rebirth to the time of year. But there's still one more twist and turn to the month that comes at the end of the month. A newspaper reports that Grant is not the author of his own memoirs, that in fact, Adam Baddow is ghostwriting them for Grant. Twain goes ballistic from his office in Hartford, Connecticut, starts to threaten to sue everybody he possibly can. He knows that this would, you know, be a potential financial disaster for him. And everyone turns to Baddow to publicly say, no, I'm not the ghost author. But that afternoon, the same afternoon that the story breaks, Baddow comes into Grant's office and he passes Grant a note, bows, turns around and leaves. And as Grant opens it up and he looks, the letter says that if for an additional $10,000 on top of what you've already agreed to pay me, I will publicly proclaim that you are the author of your own memoirs and that I am just assisting. And Grant just can't believe that this man he trusted, this man he's worked so closely with, is trying to blackmail him. And once upon a time, maybe Grant might have succumbed to this. After all, Badaw was a nationally known writer. He was a theater critic for New York papers. A best-selling author. He's written the definitive military history of Ulysses S. Grant. But because Grant has found that pride of authorship, he's not going to let this pass. And Grant realizes, and he writes later on, that he realized that he's a writer. Yeah. And in fact, he's been a writer. He looks back at his career, and while he was a general, he wrote out all his own orders, which had a reputation for being clear and immediately understandable. When he was president, he wrote out all his own correspondence that was regular for that office holder to write, he says. He has been writing his whole life, and his own insecurities about being a writer really were unfounded, as he has discovered writing his own memoirs and hearing the praise of men who respect him, like Twain, like Robert Underwood Johnson. And so rather than submitting to Badaw's blackmail, he lets Badaw have it. And the letter he writes is fantastic. And it's basically like, you're an awful human being. Nobody likes you. They only put up with you because of me. Like, your mom doesn't even like you. You shouldn't procreate. You're terrible. And then he ends it with this remarkable last sentence: if there's anything I can ever do to be of service to you, please don't hesitate to call on me. And he actually ends the letter that way. And Badaw is banished. Out he goes. He leaves the story. That's it. Badaw will actually write his own book about Grant's last days, as though he were still kind of a part of the cool kids club, as though he was one of the insiders. But at this point, Badaw is on the outside. Grant goes back to work. He's feeling invigorated. He wants to see this through. He knows that his health is failing. His doctors realize that. They want to get him out of the city before summer arrives because they don't think he's going to survive the summer heat. They find a place for him north of Saratoga Springs in what is today Wilton, New York, the mountaintop resort, brand new, the Balmoral Hotel at Mount McGregor. The Drexel family of Philadelphia, they're major investors. In fact, they have built their own private cottage next to the hotel. They haven't even moved into it yet. And they offer the place to Grant as a refuge for him to spend the summer. So everyone's going to move him up there where it's going to be cooler and he can get out of the city. One last duty to perform before he goes, though. And that, again, comes at Memorial Day. And as New York City's parade marches up Broadway, the parade marshals actually take a detour from their usual route, and they will turn down East 66th Street and march the army past Grant's townhouse. And he will stand in his second floor bedroom window and watch his old army march past for one final time. And they salute him, and he salutes them. And it is his final fond farewell to his soldiers. By mid-June, everything is ready for his trip north. They'll put him on a train. He borrows the private locomotive and passenger car of William Vanderbilt, who makes yet one more generous loan. And Grant will go north up the Hudson River. It's a hot day, reaches almost 100 degrees. He's sitting in this train, and because of the heat, has to have the windows down, but the soot and smoke from the locomotive swirls in around him, so it's a miserable, miserable trip north. But it's almost like going back in time, where he passes that spot where he had his last cigar. He passes West Point, where the cadets all come out and wait on the banks to the river to salute the train as it goes by, all of them wearing their dress uniforms. And he gets to Saratoga Springs, where they have to switch trains. He is so exhausted, he still gets out, tries to greet the crowd. He's got to be helped into a smaller train that takes him the 7 miles up the winding path to the Balmoral at the top of Mount McGregor, where he disembarks and wants to walk up to the cottage, the picture of which is behind me. Let me move this way. Halfway up to the cottage, he actually trips. And the two men that are escorting him, two veterans, they're now police officers. They grab him. They're able to help him the rest of the way up and into the cabin. He's so spent by this trip that it'll be 3 days before he's able to come out. But on that fourth day, he'll come out, situate himself in a nice shady spot, take in the weather. and then begin work on his book again. By this point, his voice is pretty much shot. He's not able to speak much, which turns out to be a great boon for us as historians, because what he does instead is he has a pencil and he will write out on slips of paper anything he wants to say. And so we have the last 6 weeks of Grant's life captured in what his secretary, Noble Dawson, calls pencil talk, which becomes a remarkable gift to us. We can see what's going through his mind and what he's thinking as he's working on these last pages. His wife, Julia, is terribly worried that the book is killing him. But Fred says, no, it's the book that's keeping him alive right now. Grant will come out in the mornings. He'll write a little bit. He'll take a break, usually entertain visitors who come to see him. Sometimes it's just gawkers from the hotel who want to come down and see Grant and stare at him. But dignitaries come to see him as well. Robert Underwood Johnson, for instance, comes up to see him, old comrades in arms from the Army. My favorite visitor is Simon Bolivar Buckner. The two of them had been friends in the pre-war Army. When Grant was out west and left the Army under cloud, sails all the way around to the Cape of Good Hope to southern tip of South Africa. Good Hope is Africa, right? What's the Horn down in South Africa. Comes up and around, lands in New York, and runs out of money. But Buckner is there. Buckner lends him the money so he can get the rest of the way home to Illinois. Well, of course, as you know, Buckner is put in charge of the surrender of Confederate forces at Fort Donelson. And after that surrender, Grant pulls Buckner aside and says, "Do you have enough money to get home?" You know, he remembers that earlier loan, and Buckner says, "No, I'll be fine." And, you know, and the two of them remain friends after the war. Well, Buckner is recently married. At this point, Buckner is in his early 60s. His wife is in her early 20s. And they've gone on their honeymoon to Niagara Falls. And on their way back through, they go to Mount McGregor to see Grant. And this is where the pencil talk is just magnificent, because these two old buddies just start busting each other's chops. And you get to see Grant's side of the conversation. And it's basically like, oh, you know, Mrs. Buckner looks wonderful, and you know, what a lovely wife you have, but you're looking like a grizzled old goat, you know, and it's just that kind of chops busting, which is great. In the course of that conversation, Grant mentions that, you know, he's pleased with the spirit of reconciliation that has brought North and South together. And it seems, he says, that only Generals Early and D.H. Hill seem dissatisfied, but everyone else seems to be okay. Those are going to be words that would become ironic and haunt him over the years, because Early and Hill would lead what becomes the charge known as the Lost Cause, that would basically ruin Grant's reputation because they are so disaffected with how things turned out. But from where Grant sees it on that porch in late June, things are looking pretty good between North and South. In fact, he dedicates his memoirs to the soldiers and sailors of the late war. His son Fred says, "Well, don't you mean the Northern soldiers?" And Grant says, no, it's perfect just as it is. And he says at one point that he has done more dying than most men are able to do living. Because so many people write to him, men from North and South, wishing this old soldier well, hoping that if he's not able to get well, that at least his last days pass peacefully. Even Jefferson Davis tells the media that Grant has been through great tribulations and we should allow the man to have his peace now. And so this is how Grant will spend his last 6 weeks on the porch behind me, working on his memoirs, greeting visitors. He'll break for lunch, which consists nothing more of broth at this point. Doctors will tend to his wounds. Dr. Schrady and Douglas actually go up to Mount McGregor with him to tend him. In the afternoons or in the evenings, his family will read back to him what he has written during the day, and he'll make notes of what he wants to work on the next day. Then when he's napping, his son Fred, his secretary Noble Dawson, they'll do fact checking to try to make sure things are accurate, and then he'll do the same thing the next day over and over. Until finally, on July 20th, about midway through the morning, Grant sets his pen down, and his pencil, excuse me, sets his pencil down, and he's finished. One of the last things he writes is actually a letter to his wife that he tucks along with his wedding ring into a pocket in his coat. And the note says that you'll find this after I die. And I want you to make sure that our children and our grandchildren are raised to be fine, decent people as they're already turning out to be. You'll know what to do. To celebrate the completion of this work, which at this point ends up being 1,231 pages, 291,000 words, monumental effort, two volumes. Grant will celebrate this by going out to a lookout on the side of the mountain, not far from the hotel, that overlooks the Hudson Valley. And everyone will get down there, and it's only a couple hundred yards away from the front porch behind me. But it's such an exhausting trip, even with Grant in a wheelchair, that they have to turn around and go back up. Grant is completely spent, even by this little trip down to the overlook. And it's a beautiful overlook. You can go out there today still and stand there and look out over the Hudson Valley. Beautiful, beautiful view to the east. They decide, because the trip down there was exhausting, they're going to try a shortcut to get back up there, but they get lost in the woods. Shortcuts make for long delays, as the old saying goes. And so Grant has to get out of his bath chair at one point and walk across railroad tracks. Finally gets to the porch. He's so spent, they take him inside. He's on the verge of collapse. They lay him down in his two chairs. Basically, he's got to sit upright. With one high back chair behind him, his feet stretched across to a high back chair in front of him. But because this has been such an ordeal, they actually bring a bed down into the main room for him. It's almost like a transformer, because it looks like a desk during the day, a credenza during the day. And then you unfold it and it turns into this bed. And they actually lay Grant down for the first time in months. The 21st is too weak to get up. 22nd, things are so bad, they actually call the family in. They don't expect Grant to survive the day. Most of the family is already there. He's got other family members that are trying to mobilize from the city to get up. Buck is trying to get there. And Grant is kind of looking around, and he's still conscious at this point, and he's surprised all this activity for me. Everyone's like, oh, you'll be okay. But Grant realizes that this is it. He's not going to be okay, but he feels okay. He got the book finished. He met his deadline. The next morning, on Thursday, July 23rd, Dr. Douglas, first person in the house to wake, and he goes down to the overlook to watch the sunrise over the Hudson Valley. And as the sun is coming up, rising up into the sky, a nurse comes running down from the house. Dr. Douglas, you've got to come up. And Douglas sprints up the hillside and gets into the house. And Grant's breathing is shallow and rapid. His pallor is so pale that they think he's going to go any second. And they mobilize the household and get the family members to come down. And the house is just a bustle with people as everyone kind of thunders down the stairs, and they gather around the bedside. Above Grant's bed is a portrait of President Lincoln. And then further down the wall is a portrait of President Grant. And so his bed is underneath Lincoln's portrait, and is the family is gathered around him. He opens his eyes. He asks for a drink of water, and they give him a sip of water. But then he lapses into unconsciousness, and he's not going to wake up again. And his breathing just then starts to slow down and get slower. And a newspaper correspondent sets the scene. He talks about that sun rising up, casting light through a window on the opposite side of the room, straight across onto the portrait of Lincoln. And as the sun goes up, that sunbeam creeps down the wall, and it finally rests over Grant's face, even as, the story goes, he takes his last breath. And across the room, there's a final breeze that rustles the curtains. And Grant is gone. Fred, who's standing by the bed, will walk over to a fireplace across the room where there's a clock on the mantle, and he'll stop that clock at 8:08 a.m. And you can go to that room today, and that clock is still above that fireplace on the mantle, and it still says 8:08. A pretty sublime juxtaposition for those of you who've been down to the Jackson death site and seen the clock on the fireplace mantle in the room where Jackson died. And you can go and stand next to that bed, which is still there in that same spot. And so the great hero of the age passes. But what he leaves behind is not just his memoirs, not just his way of saying what the war meant and what the country means and what that sacrifice was for, and not just his stamp on that spirit of reconciliation that was so important to so many Americans. But what he leaves behind is security for his family. This is a book that will never go out of print, at least it hasn't yet. It'll sell so many copies in its first 6 months that Twain will give Julia a royalty check for $250,000. She'll get $400,000 by the end of the first year. Twain knew that this would be a moneymaker. He said, everyone in America will be morally obligated to buy a copy. And he was right. One out of four Americans end up getting a copy of Grant's memoirs. Becomes a huge bestseller, and some even today consider it to be one of the greatest works of nonfiction in American history, which ironically is published at the same time Twain is doing Huckleberry Finn, which is considered one of the great works of American fiction. And Twain has his hands involved with both projects. Pretty phenomenal. If you haven't read Grant's memoirs, I would urge you to go do so. Remember, though, they are memoirs. It's not a history. It's not an autobiography. He does go to great lengths to try to make sure it's got, you know, the factual accuracy is there. But in his pencil talk, he says, gosh, if I had more time, I would write more about Spotsylvania, or I would write more about North Anna. He writes that he would say more about Cold Harbor. Most people say, like, oh, he didn't say anything about Cold Harbor except he regretted that. Oh, he must really regret it. He was dying. He didn't have time to flesh it out the way he actually wanted to. As he says in the foreword of his book, you may be dissatisfied with the final outcome. If I'd had more time, I would have done a better job. But man proposes and God disposes. But what we're left with is an incredible history of the war as he saw it. And that's the thing that makes a memoir different than other forms of nonfiction. It's how he saw the war. And as such, it makes it a valuable piece for us as historians. But it still makes for relevant reading for someone who's not necessarily a professional historian. But I think the thing that's the absolute most important thing for us to remember is that he's the guy who saves the country. He's the president of the United States. He writes this just monumental work of nonfiction. But he does this for his family. He started this project because he was destitute and he wanted to provide for his family after he was gone. And Julia is able to pay off all of those debts from the proceeds of these books. And she does have that financial security. And I invite you to think as we finish tonight, which one of you would not do the same thing for your loved ones if you had the opportunity? Great marble man, great historical figure or not, he is a father and a husband who wants to do right by his family. If there is ever a reason for someone to turn back, that would be why. And to that, I think we owe him a great, great debt of thanks. So, thank you very much. We're glad to answer whatever questions you guys have tonight. I have prattled on at you guys for long enough.
So, there we go.
There we go. Santa Claus has turned on his microphone.
But yep, that's right. That's right. Very good there, Chris. You have a bunch of people that are saying fantastic. Thank you very much. Ulysses got another copy of his memoirs recently. Joe asked, what became of Ferdinand Ward?
Ward, great character. Jeffrey Ward, who is the writing partner for Ken Burns. He's actually the one who wrote the script for the Civil War, for instance. He's a great grandson of Ferdinand Ward, and he's got a fantastic book about his ancestor. Ward was slimy and awful to the end. So he's going to serve out part, you know, most of his prison sentence. He's going to bribe one of the guards to get out of jail so he can go watch Grant's funeral procession in New York City. And then he'll go back into jail and go off into his prison sentence. He will end up marrying a rich heiress. He'll take her for fleece her out of her money, abuse her. He'll try to kidnap his own child after she leaves him. It one torrid story after another for his whole life. He'll get involved in a number of other get-rich schemes. He never learns his lesson from all this. He's a horrible human being.
All right. Let's see. Pete says that $16.5 million in 1884 is worth $436 million today. So it has appreciated.
That's not chump change, is it?
No, that's right. That's right. Absolutely not. Yep. We have Dave says he's read your book, Chris. It's excellent. Like all of your books. We've had it in the Manassas Museum, at least we did before the last time he went there, which is always the case. We don't know when we can go back to places. Greg says that he wanted to buy your book already through the Emerging Civil War website, but he got an error message with Sidus Beatty.
I would send people to savisbeatty.com. You can order straight from the publisher. They'll send you an autographed book plate and support independent publishing, particularly this time of the pandemic. A lot of independent publishers are really having a tough time. You can go to Amazon, you can go to Barnes & Noble, but I would really encourage you to go to the publishers themselves and support independent publishing that way.
Yep, absolutely.
I see someone asked me what a fascinating question. If Grant were alive today, this is from Roy Shrout. If Grant were alive today and you had the chance to ask him one question, what would it be? Roy, that is such a great question. I would ask him, what did you think of your presidency? Which is, now undergoing a lot of really much needed critical reexamination. Grant dies, and so he doesn't ever write about that part in his book. He pretty much talks about the war. And I would have loved to know what he thought about his presidency, because it does get such mixed evaluations. But for a long time, he was just considered a failure as a president. But I think we're now looking at a lot of the achievements he's done, particularly with civil rights. We understand kind of the misplaced loyalty he had with some people, and that's what really got him into trouble, Orville Babcock, for instance. So I'd just like to pick his brain about that.
Let's see. Ulysses asks, what do you think of Elizabeth Sammet's animated memoirs?
So her memoirs came out shortly after John Marzulek's annotated memoirs came out. John Marzulek is the editor of the Ulysses S. Grant papers, which are housed, ironically, at Mississippi State. So he came out with what I thought were just a fantastic set of annotated memoirs, the first time that memoirs had been annotated. And then Elizabeth Sammet, who teaches up at West Point, she came out with hers. And her footnotes are really entertaining. You'd think like one set of memoirs versus the other. Marzulek's are thorough, they're informative, they're factual, they're enlightening. Sammet's are both enlightening and entertaining. So it's kind of a neat comparison between the two.
All right. Let's see. People have been to the Long Branch. They've been to that house. Does the New York townhouse still exist?
It does not. There's actually another building on that location, but there's a plaque on the front of the building that says this is where Grant's home used to be. So I have tracked that down. There's a picture of the plaque in this very informative book. If anybody's
you have to buy the book to get the plaque, yes. Are you familiar with the Grant Monument Association?
Yes.
Reformed to repair the tomb.
So by the 1980s, Grant's tomb, which in its day was one of the most magnificent structures in Manhattan, and it was on this high bluff. You could see it all the way from the southern tip of Manhattan Island. Well, then, you know, the neighborhood built up around it and stuff. And by the mid-1980s, it was in deplorable condition. Graffiti, there were druggies everywhere. People defecated in the tomb. And a guy named Frank Scaturro actually sued the National Park Service to force them to devote the funds to clean the place up. And it has since been totally rehabilitated. It is a wonderful site, pretty easy to get to. It's near Columbia University, safe neighborhood to park and get out. And I highly encourage anybody, if you're in New York City, to go and take a look at it. It's a wonderful, wonderful spot. I'll also just give a pitch to Grant Cottage. I know it's a little out of the way, particularly for folks in Northern Virginia, but it is one of the most fantastic sites, historic sites you can go. And you go right in the room where Grant died, stand right next to the bed. You can touch the side of the bed. They've got a great historical staff. It's run by the Friends of Grant Cottage, grantcottage.org. It's a state historical site run by this very robust volunteer friends group. And I can't recommend that place enough. It's just great.
Indeed. And then Grant's home in Missouri is also a national park site.
In St. Louis.
Yeah.
Actually, Ulysses S. Grant National Historic Site. A friend of mine, Nick Sacco, works out there. The house is lime green, which is the color it was at the time. And they do a really, I think, a wonderful job. My favorite part of that site is in the museum. There's a whole room that talks about all of these different Grant myths and stereotypes. Grant the butcher, Grant the drunk, Grant the inept, and then it explores those myths and how those myths actually came about. So it's just a fantastic piece of interpretation. Really like that site a lot.
Yep. Tim says that Grant's tomb is right across from the Cathedral of St. John's the Divine, which is also magnificent and worth seeing on that side up there in New York. Let's see.
Someone sent me a private message. They asked, what did I think of Ron Chernow's book on Grant? I didn't think Chernow added anything new to the conversation. For those of us who know about Grant, Chernow didn't really bring anything new to the conversation. And I think he belabored the point about Grant's drinking. Like, Chernow decided to make it his mission to make the definitive statement on Grant's drinking, which we don't really have the definitive answer on. I think Chernow read into the tea leaves a little too much there to try to make his statement. That all said, he introduced Grant to a huge audience that otherwise would not have met Grant. And I think that's just been such a fantastic service to Grant and his career. Visitation at sites like Grant Cottage, at the Grant site in St. Louis, they've all told me that when that book came out, they saw an influx of visitors who came there and they're like, I read the book, I wanted to come see the place. So, you know, there's been that sort of benefit to it as well. So you know, overall, I give it a thumbs up.
All right. Doug O'Boyd asked, what regrets, if any, did Grant have about the war or about his presidency?
We don't really know. He didn't talk about his presidency a lot, even in his private writings. And I have copies of Grant's official papers, and the annotations in those are, again, very enlightening. He doesn't spend a whole lot of time reflecting on it. He wasn't one of those guys, you know, going back to that no turning back attitude, but he didn't spend a lot of time reflecting on where he had been until he actually starts writing his memoirs.
Okay. Did Grant keep in touch with Frederick Douglass in the latter part of his life?
Not especially. You know, they had a, you know, a very important business relationship. Grant admired Douglas and what Douglas tried to do for Friedman after the war. But once Grant was out of power and he was traveling around the world, Douglas was still very focused on the work that still needed to be done in Reconstruction.
Okay. All right. I don't see any other questions per se.
Jim, I'd like to ask one.
Sure. Mark?
Chris, did you find any evidence of Mark Twain's editing in the memoirs?
It's funny because some people even today still buy into that misconception that Grant didn't write his memoirs, that Twain ghost wrote them. Twain didn't do a whole lot of editing. Grant turned in a lot of pretty clean copy. And in fact, Twain got frustrated because Grant kept insisting on doing more and more editing. So even, you know, one of the things Grant was doing at the cottage is as he's pushing forward on the end of book two, he's going over the galley proofs for book one and still making changes and edits. And Twain's like, this is already typeset. What are you doing? You know? So Twain didn't have to do a whole lot of editing himself at all. He just let Grant do his thing. And the nice thing again too, because Grant's writing all of this stuff in pencil. I mean, we know what Grant's handwriting looked like. We match everything up. There's no textual physical evidence that Twain did any of this writing. Or any extensive editing at all. So.
All right. Somebody on an iPhone says Grant and Longstreet were fourth cousins by marriage.
In fact, when they were stationed together out in St. Louis and Grant got married, Longstreet stood up for him. Was in the wedding party. By some accounts, Longstreet was Grant's best man. This is why I always contend when Longstreet is wounded in the wilderness, that's a more grievous blow for Lee than Jackson's wounding at Chancellorsville the year before, because Grant coming to the East, nobody knows anything about him, you know, and Lee doesn't have a sense of this guy. The only person in Lee's army that knows anything about Grant is Longstreet. And Longstreet says, like, this man will come at us, and he will come at us every day until we are driven into the river. And then Longstreet's taken off the board. And so Lee has no insight into this guy at all. And if you look at the Overland campaign, Lee misreads Grant over and over and over. Longstreet would have been really useful during that stretch.
They make note that Longstreet's mother's maiden name was Dent. And it goes back to General John Dent from the Revolutionary War. And wasn't Grant's wife's maiden name Dent?
Julia Dent was her name. So she's from the Dent family. So that's where that connection was. Longstreet was her cousin.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. Joe asks, does the longhand draft still exist?
Yes. The Library of Congress, I think.
Really? It's part of their memorial archives?
I'm not 100% sure about that.
Okay.
Kim, wouldn't it be the archives?
I take that back. I think they're with the Grant papers out in Mississippi.
Ah, okay. All right. Let's see. All right. I know that... one of our members who couldn't be with us for all of tonight, Lynn Garvey Hodge, wanted to make note for people that the 16th annual conference, history conference for Fairfax County, the theme is the history of the suffrage movement, and that conference will take place on November 14th and 15th. And she's got more information for you. So let's see, anybody else? How did Grant's papers end up in Mississippi?
I can't remember the exact story. But whoever had a lot of that stuff wanted to donate it to like University of Chicago or something like that. And they didn't want it. And somehow they ended up, it's a funny story and I can't remember it off the top of my head, but it's a really weird place for that stuff to have ended up. But they have done a wonderful job curating those. You can go, there's a small museum that you can go to down there. And I can't say enough nice things about John Marsalek, the man who's the editor in charge of the papers, did a wonderful job.
And isn't a whole bunch of the Abe Lincoln collection is down in Mississippi.
Same.
The judge from Rhode Island, who was, I knew him up in Rhode Island. He put all of his stuff down in the Mississippi Museum.
In part because they had done such a good job with Grant's stuff that he wanted them to have the Lincoln stuff too.
Okay, great. Good to know. All right, anything else from anybody? I don't see anybody else questions on that side.
Mark Kerbovich here. Chris, thank you so much. I know you went through a lot to do this presentation, and bravo, sir, and best of luck to you in the future. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Mark. I appreciate it. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in tonight. I know it's a little unconventional, but I really enjoyed myself, and as always, enjoying the chance to hang out with the Bull Run Roundtable.
Absolutely. We have a couple of other final things to mention for people. Certainly, we'll have a survey. Eric Sebastian is doing Survey Monkey to get your views on that side. And for our next meeting is September 10th with Christian Pollack, talking about the Battle of Williams Creek in Missouri, August of 1861. And I've convinced her because I was out at the Civil War Congress's event down in St. Louis. She's going to do some behind the scenes tour of the Missouri Civil War Museum, which her father runs, and there's a picture of it there. So by all means, join us on September 10th. And with that ends the show. Thank you all for attending.
Kim, thank you for hosting.
Yep.
Thank you, Kim.
Indeed. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you,
Chris.
Hey, Kim, it's Lynn. I had to leave very early, and I tried to pop back in at the end. Did you get to read my commentaries about the concern with the Confederate street names and markers and to contact me? I have a real sensitivity about what all is going on with that right now, and I want to make sure we keep lines of communication open.
I didn't get to that part of it, but I did note that you had made some comments there.
Okay.
So certainly we'll have the Zoom chat available, and certainly sending your comments to someone like Greg would be great on that side.
Perfect. Okay. I just want to make sure that we're all talking.
Yep. Absolutely. Right. Well, we're interested in what the Fairfax is doing, even though we're the small stepsister of you guys up there.
Well, it's, you know, there's so many new supervisors. That's the problem. And so we've got to do a lot of education and be patient and encourage and be the shining stars that you guys already are. So,
well, we have a lot of new ones also in Prince William County. And so our historic commission, which I'm chairman of, we talked about that and getting to meet all the new members on that side.
Good. All right. Good. All right. Perfect. I'm going to sign off then. Thank you, Kim. Good to see you, Mark. I'm sorry I was so sketchy tonight. We were planning the conference tonight, so that was where I left off to. Thank you.
Great. All right. Thanks, everybody. We're going to close down.
Be safe.